It's my pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Travis Wernett. Projective imaginal dream work, honoring dreams, and learning to work with them. I don't think I have to say much about Travis. I think a lot of people already know about you and your work, who they've been here to your previous events know you. So I will leave most of the introduction to you.
Okay.
We're delighted to have you back at Many Rivers.
I'm delighted to be back. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, I see many faces that I know tonight, faces from other talks and faces from the groups, and it's wonderful to be here. I'm always grateful for the opportunity to talk about the work that I do. What I'd like to do is actually start with some sound, and one of the unique elements of the work that I do is I am weaving music and sound healing together with the work with dreams. And what I'm finding is that music itself, when played in certain ways and in certain fashions, actually supports the experience of entering into a dreamlike state. Dreamlike meaning it feels like a dream, not dreamlike as in it's not real. So an old practice, and a practice of cultures for thousands and thousands of years, is that when people gather like this in community to learn something and to understand something together, that one of the first things to do is to bring music and to bring sound. Some cultures do it through the voice and through actually singing songs with the voice. I've been playing the didgeridoo, which is originally an Australian instrument that is at least 40,000 years old. And I've been playing this instrument not for 40,000 years, but for about 17 or 18 years. So I'd like to start with just, I'm thinking of this tonight as a sound blessing. And the word blessing itself is quite an interesting word, because the root of the word, which I believe comes from the French, blessure, means literally to open up so that the divine can enter. So I would like to open the evening up so that the divine can enter and help us and assist us in our undertaking this evening by playing the didgeridoo. We're essentially calling the spirit in, so it occurs to me that it's a good idea to perhaps invite, you know, we could invite any number of spirits and they might show up. So what I would like to suggest is that we actually invite the spirit of understanding and the spirit of community. So if you like, you can close your eyes and take some deep full-bodied breaths, some Buddha belly breaths while I'm playing the instrument. And if you just want to sit there and receive the sound, that's good with me as well.
Yeah. Thank you. There's a saying by the Native American Iroquois people, the dream world is the real world. And I like this saying very much, and it rings true to my experience. I've been working with dreams for about 17 years now, and for the last 3 years, I've been offering ongoing, steady Wednesday night and Monday groups in this area, in Sebastopol and Occidental. About a year and a half ago, or was it 2 years ago, I was ordained as a Unitarian Universal Life Minister, and I'm also a graduate of the Marin Institute for Projective Dreaming. I've done this type of work with small groups, I've done this type of work with larger groups, and I've also offered dream work in communities like in mental health. I used to work in mental health in San Francisco, and I did that for about 9 years. So I've had a good opportunity to get a sense of what my own dreams and even what others' dreams seem to be saying. And I wanted to start out with that quote and that idea. It's more than a quote, really. You know, it's the experience of time and tested experience by dreamers. It's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration to say that the dream world is the real world, because if we accept that, then what are we to make of this world that we're within at the moment, right? One of the connected thoughts, however, is that right now it seems like the dream world is like this, you know, mysterious place. If we just sort of stop and pull back a little bit and start imagining our dreams, they might not seem as real as right now, as the sound of my voice or whatever's going on behind me. But when we're dreaming, the dreams themselves are quite real. And this world here, actually, I think, I've thought about this, and when I've imagined myself back into my own dreams, one of the things that happens is most of the dreams, if not all of the dreams that I can remember, I'm not really like aware of what's happening in this reality, which just underscores for me and my experience the important point that dreams are real experiences. And I'm starting with this because it's also been my experience that in our culture, it's very easy to discount and devalue the imagination. And for me, I'm really serious about the experience of imagination. Imagination and dreams are like this, as far as I can tell, as near as I can tell. And one of the things that is the major obstacles to this work, as I do it, and I think in any valuable, ethical, integral form of trying to understand our dreams in order to understand ourselves better, one of the biggest obstacles is a phenomenon that's called mistaken literalism. That, to give a short example, let's say I have a dream wherein I'm having sex with another person. Let's say, you know, for the sake of the example, I'm in a committed relationship. So let's say I dream that I'm having a sensual sexual experience with another woman. If I wake up and I say to myself, oh my God, you know, this dream is telling me, like, am I desiring to have an affair with another woman? That would be like a primary example of mistaken literalism. And the reason I'm using that example is because actually, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but this is the kind of dream that we have, and we step back and we say, oh no, you know, something's wrong here. And really, it's due to a missing piece in our understanding. In the West here, you know, from the time of the age of the Enlightenment, we've really lost to a large extent. I think we're recovering it now in a wonderful way, but to a large extent we've lost the ability to see things and understand things from a symbolic, from a mythic and a metaphoric level of experience. And I'm saying this because one of the biggest phenomenon that I still witness, even in my own understanding of my own dreams, is the tendency to read what's happening in the dream from a literal standpoint and to misunderstand the metaphors and the symbols of the dreams. It's also come up a few times this week in my own work and in working with others. Let me say a little bit more about my background and what I do. Right now, I'm leading a total of 5 dream work groups. And the Occidental group meets every 2 weeks. The Sebastopol, I have 2 Sebastopol groups now, actually, also meets every 2 weeks. And I'm also doing a teleconference group, which is really interesting, working dreams on the telephone. When I initially thought of doing this, it was actually a strong suggestion of a mentor to start a dream group by teleconference. I thought, you know, that's going to be kind of weird. You know, people can't see each other. And, but I was willing to give it a shot, and I gave it a shot. And as it turns out, it's really like, it's one of the most cooking groups that we have at the moment. And it's interesting to experience doing the group work in that context where we hear each other's voices, you know. So it's, I call it the disembodied voice group. There's a primary foundational toolkit that I work with that was created by Jeremy Taylor. Jeremy Taylor is the founder of the Marin Institute of Projective Dreamwork. And the basic toolkit, one of the first things that the basic toolkit talks about is how our dreams, all dreams, are speaking on an important level of universal, archetypal, metaphoric, symbolic meaning, and that there really is no such thing as a bad dream. Only dreams which often take a negative form in order to grab our attention. I'm also starting with this point on the toolkit because I think it's one of the most common things that happens to us with our dreams, and it's also one of the things that makes us like sweep it back under the rug and decide, well, you know, people say that dreams mean something, and people say that dreams are important. But I think, you know, given the dream that I just remembered, I'm going to go in some other direction. Perfectly, you know, understandable response. I've had that response myself to my own dreams. One of the reasons that I think it's so wonderful and so important and so valuable to work with dreams is that the dreams themselves provide a foundational practice. Paying attention to the dreams themselves provides a foundational practice from which folks of all different walks of life, all different spiritual traditions, all different backgrounds can draw from this source. I think of it as a source that springs from deep within. And at the end of the day, my experience of dreams and the way that I teach about doing dream work states that, you know, it's an inviolable center within each one of us, a source of wisdom that visits us every single night for free. You know, in essence. Whether it's actually for free or not is debatable once one starts to do the work and realize some of the demands that are made. I don't know if we necessarily want to call them demands, but sometimes it feels that way. The diversity that is involved and is possible in doing this work is really astounding. And I'm really wanting to talk tonight about the group experience. It's not the only type of dream work that I do. I also do one-on-one work, and I also work with my own dreams. The thing is, and there's a bit of irony in this, I try every day, if I remember a dream, I try to take the time to sit down, write it down. The first step is to remember it, you know, to record it, to put it into some form that I can come back to later and say, okay, this is what I dreamt. And there are probably several folks in the room that can attest to this fact, but basically about 1 hour, 1 hour is the average. If we haven't written it down, if we haven't recorded it or told somebody else about it, usually it slips away, and sometimes a lot quicker than that. The irony to dream work is, and I can say this really feel it, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool introvert. So my preference would be to just sort of stay at home, remember my dreams, work on them, understand them, and tap the wisdom that they have for me, and just sort of proceed in that fashion. There's a feature of working with dreams, however, that I think also applies to waking life and to all other situations, which is called unique blindness, which states that basically, in looking at my own material, I will be necessarily uniquely blind to the inherent meanings and experiences spoken about and shown to me in my own dreams. So, what's a dreamer to do? And it turns out that working, and several of you might even be able to remember an occasion when you just simply shared a dream with another person, and all of a sudden a little bit of the meaning, or in some cases a lot of the meaning, might have just sort of shaken out in just telling it to another person. Oh, gee, I just told you about my dream, and all of a sudden it's like making all kinds of sense to me. Wow, isn't that interesting? Basically, the group work that I do is taking that and really expanding it. And what tends to happen in the groups is that dreamers come together. The groups are usually like anywhere from 4 to 8 people in number. And what happens is we share our dreams. Usually in one group meeting, 1 or 2 people will have a chance to share a dream, usually 2. And we also use the sound healing as a support for the practice. What happens is when we share our dreams with other people then are able to share their ideas and impressions about the dreams themselves. And it really is a highly effective, and even, I don't want to say fast, but it's a more facilitated experience where I had the occasion to work a dream of my own on Monday with a group of 20 dream workers on a video online group on Zoom. And one of the things I noticed was that in about 45 minutes, I had way more material around my own dream to work with and to look at than I could have probably produced by myself in the course of 2 hours. You know, it might have taken me 2 or 3 hours, and I wouldn't have even gotten all of the insights that were offered to me because of this thing that I'm talking about, unique blindness. Within the group experience, there's some really important techniques that it turns out make it really possible to talk about one another's dreams and to maintain a sense of respect and to maintain a sense of one's own individuality. If that wasn't the case, I wouldn't be sitting here in front of you tonight talking about this, talking about groups and talking about sharing dreams, because I'm sure long ago I probably would have decided to abandon ship, being as introverted and shy as I tend to be myself. The structure of the groups I want to talk about a little bit, because I think at the other talks that I've given about dreams, I've sort of spoken more about like what dreaming seems to be. And I'd be happy to talk a little bit about that tonight, but I really want to provide a picture of what the work is like and the possibilities that exist around doing this work. One of the points on the toolkit states that only the dreamer can say, and I'm offering this to you no matter, you know, whether we see each other again, no matter whether any of you decide to come and check out a group or do some individual work, this is like, you know, free helpful information. Only the dreamer can say with any certainty what meaning her dream or his dream has. That's one of the sort of ethical standards of the work that I do, and it really is one of the most helpful ideas around doing work with dreams that I've encountered. To me, it seems like there's no greater waste of time than to be talking about something that's important to me and then to get into an argument about who's right about what. And that tends to happen when we use what I call you language, you know, when people start trying to tell each other what's right for them, right for each other. Like if I said to John, like, hey man, you know, you really should get your life together. You know, that's what it looks like to me. Whoa, you know, what does that feel like? That doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good at all. And so I'm not saying that to you. I take that back. If I can just express myself in I statements, which is what we do in the groups, somebody shares a dream. Let's say the dream is about driving a tractor across a field, okay? And we can suddenly begin to talk about the dream of the tractor being driven across the field. First of all, if there's 6 people in the group, as soon and as many number of people are here in the room tonight, now everybody has their own version of like this tractor driving across a field, you know. That's different than, you know, the version that I shared or the version that I had in my mind. We all have our own version of it. So one of the techniques of this work, one of the avenues is to actually honor that and to express the truth of that and to say, well, you know, if it were my dream, it might have something to do with my need to plow under the old growth in my life and make room for the new stuff that wants to emerge. Kind of like that. And so this is one of the ways that, along with maintaining the individual ownership around the meaning of the dream, we also, the rest of the group also own any insights, ideas. We call them projections, you know. And basically, folks in this room, I imagine, in general, the level of awareness around the things that I teach and talk about in the groups is very high in this part of the world. But let me say a few things about projection and what that word means to me. In projective style dream work, the idea and the experience and the reality is that everybody is making this effort in doing the dream work to actually own at that moment. If I have an insight about somebody else's dream, I'm making the effort in that moment to own that that's true, at least for me. And this means that we can work dreams in groups, and at the same time that we can work for the dreamer and seek to produce helpful insights and ahas and, you know, great ideas that might be of service to the person who has shared the dream, at the same time, the people who are talking about the dream and looking at the dream together also get to do our work as we look at the dream. Now, because all dreams speak in a universal language of metaphor and symbol, sometimes dreams also speak in actual literal language too. But in my experience, even when they're speaking in literal actual language, they're also speaking in this important metaphorical, mythical, symbolic language. The fact that on one important level all dreams speak a universal language means that any of the insights that are being shared are very likely to hit a universal layer of meaning for the dreamer as the dream is being discussed. Now, on one level, this is like really risky work because we all get together. None of us really know what the dream is about. The dreamer is suffering from unique blindness over here. You know, the dreamer shares the dream. The rest of the people in the group are kind of, you know, going, wow, that's really interesting. But it's very dreamlike and very symbolic and very metaphoric. And on another level, we're actually establishing a relationship with the unconscious in the language of archetypal psychology. The unconscious is simply that which we don't know that we don't know. And that's, as Carl Jung said, that's the basic problem with the unconscious. The problem with the unconscious is it really is unconscious. So we don't know what we don't know. And that's another really good reason for working with dreams. In my experience over the last 17 years, it serves as a really helpful practice for recovering the lost pieces, the lost layers of myself. And I see it happen for other people on an ongoing basis. And there are even layers that are collective that can be reclaimed. So it's really rich and valuable work. The dreams themselves, I've said this before at the previous talks, and I'll say it again just as a refresher, dreams themselves are speaking on multiple layers of meaning at the same time. There really is no such thing as a dream with only one meaning. And what happens when we do the groups and we do the experience, we do the experiential work, what happens is we all start off and we're like kind of, you know, scratching our heads, we're in this unconscious place. It's also a creative practice because we just start diving in and start sharing, well, gee, what I first feel when I hear the dream being told is this sense of whatever. I'm speaking theoretically now. I'll give some examples. I just want to roll this out a little bit more. The multiple layers of meanings in dreams means that the dreamer, him or herself, gets all of this benefit and rich insight around the meanings of the dream for themselves as an individual. Simultaneously in the groups, all of the other people are having ahas, they're sharing insights, working, we're all working. Projections are basically, I said I was going to say what a projection is to me, and I never got there. I came back around to it. A projection is basically an export of, if I project, it's an exporting of all of my unconscious thoughts, feelings, ideas, desires, perceptions. So, you know, judgment might get caught up in that. And one of the ways to know for sure that we're projecting is to note whether or not there's a high degree of emotion that's connected. So like a really common example of a projection would be, I'm having a conversation with somebody, they bring up, you know, let's say global warming. And I share an impression that I have about global warming. And the person I'm speaking with doesn't agree with what I have to say, you know. Yes, it's really happening. No, it's not. Yes, it's really happening. No, it's not. I can prove all the ways that it's not happening. The more heated, the more emotional I get about the topic, the more I can be sure that some level, some layer of projection is mixed up in that moment. The thing about projection within the realm of psychology, right? Some people like feel bad, you know, about projecting. You know, like, oh, I was projecting, and oh, gee, I really should be more responsible with my stuff, and I've done so much work, and gee, how could I do that? The thing is, you know, as far as I can tell, we're on a course of evolution, personal and collective, and there's always going to be something. Just like in this moment, each one of us, to a high degree, is unaware of all the processes that are happening in the body, dinners in the stomach, it's being digested. All these things are happening that we're not aware of at the moment. In the same way, the more we expand and grow and become conscious, more things also simultaneously continue to fall into the unconscious. And really, the work with dreams is really about being willing to dive in from this day world, this waking consciousness place that we find ourselves in, into this other place where things happen in really strange and interesting ways, where it seems like my experience of dreams and dreaming, I'm convinced that the past, the present, and the future are always happening in the dream world, in my experience of dreams. And it seems that way when I hear dreams from other people. So it's really a valid and vital and important practice. I said I was going to give some examples, so let me give an example. Because my background tends to be largely in mental health, a lot of my experience has been in the mental health field. I like to share this example because it's just really a dramatic display of some of the things that I've been saying. Back when I worked in mental health, I worked with a lot of folks that were suicidal, a lot of people that had actually tried, some of them many, many, many times, to kill themselves. And it was at that time that I actually encountered this work and started learning about dreams and started becoming interested in working with them myself. One of the most common experiences was, back when I was working in these programs, we worked overnights. So we had to work, basically I was working in social rehab facilities. We had to have staff there 24/7. And there were those of us, pretty much they tried to dole it out to everybody so that every staff member would have to work an overnight, you know, so nobody would have anything to grumble about. So we all had it, you know, pretty much equally as crappy as the other. That was the idea, except for the administrators, you know, who came in and would tell us, you know, do your job better on a regular basis. And I was one of those administrators for a while. Folks who suffered from severe depression, other folks, schizophrenics, psychotics, inevitably, when I used to work overnights, would come into the office in the morning, how you doing? You know, this person comes in, they look awful, they didn't sleep, I've been checking on them all night, you know, opening their door, looking at them in bed to find out if they're asleep, to make sure that they're not killing themselves, which is one of the charges of working in these social rehabilitation programs. Invariably, folks would come in and say, well, you know, I had this awful dream last night. Oh, really? You had an awful dream? Okay. Well, let's talk about that. What happened in the dream? It turns out that not only, you know, regular folk, such as ourselves or anybody else, if we can really come up with such a definition. The closer we look, the less sense it makes, right? Normal, what's that? But even folks who suffer in this deep way and who end up sort of losing their autonomy to a certain extent and end up in these programs, suicidal folks especially have dreams about killing themselves, it turns out. And one of the pleasures that I had in doing this work was being able to talk about these dreams with folks, because you know they would come into the office. First of all, they wouldn't want to talk about their dream. No, I'm not going to tell you. No, no way. I know you're gonna increase my medication. You're gonna, you know, take me back to the hospital. And I was actually able quite often to say, well, you know, I'm just really interested in the dream. You know, can we just talk about it? I might have a few helpful things to say. There were times where, you know, I guesstimated, I had a hunch, this person is suicidal. I wonder have they had a dream of killing themselves. You know, sometimes I had to ask the question, did you think of killing yourself? You know, did you have the experience of killing yourself in your dream? And it's a really good example of mistaken literalism. And, I still meet people in my practice and in the groups who have this experience, and it feels on an important level, and all nightmares, all difficult dreams feel on an important level to a certain extent, yucky, disgusting, horrible, you know, they sometimes they're really difficult to have. But the mistaken literalism comes in. I met people in that work when I was in mental health. They were getting ready to head out the door and execute the dream. Go to the Golden Gate Bridge. Jump off of the Golden Gate Bridge in the middle of the night. This sort of thing. So it's a really dramatic example of, you know, I've found myself able to say to folks, you know, actually, can we talk about this? Suicide. You know, what would suicide look like as a metaphor, as a symbol? What does death look like as a metaphor and as a symbol, right? And it turns out that in my own experience in the dreams and also in the experience of folks that I've worked with, that suggesting this idea of the metaphor, oh, well, wait a second, what would that mean? Suicide, really? I've had dreams of killing myself. I've had recent dreams of dying. This is one of the biggest psycho-spiritual metaphors that we can identify. It's in mythology. It's in our dreams. Of deep, radical self-transformation and evolution. And that's why, you know, folks like Clarissa Pikola Estes talks in the book about the life-death life cycle. You know? That this is really how it works. This is a big part of it. And all the various world mythologies around the globe talk about this to a certain extent. It's a big part of initiation and the mythology of initiation, the storytelling and the actual experience of initiation, that in order, it's even a part of Christianity. In order to be fully alive, we have to die to ourselves. You know? So that's like one example of some of the principles that I've already spoken of. I also want to highlight just briefly, you know, along with doing group work, you know, group work has this rich potential, as I was starting to say, with the multiple levels of meanings of dreams. Dreams speak to us about physical health and wholeness. I've had folks in dream groups bring up dreams and witnessed myself and the other dreamers in the group offering insights. Wow, you know, if that were my dream, it might be about my physical health and well-being. I might think about going to my doctor, getting checked out. And it turns out, on the physical health and well-being level, there's a really good book about this. Mark Ian Barash, I'm not sure I'm saying his name correctly, he wrote a book called, the book title is Healing Dreams. And he shares stories about what happens with dreams when we pay attention to them is that they forecast way before there's actually going to be an actual manifestation of illness, what the illness is going to be and what it will look like. So the more learned we become in paying attention to our dreams and understanding them and working with the symbols and the metaphors and the literalities, the more we're able to get ahead of the curve on that. And there are actually a lot of specific techniques that can be learned to identify physical health. Every single dream, believe it or not, is on one important level like a physical readout of the dreamer's current physical health and wellness. The book I mentioned, Healing Dreams, is really interesting because pretty much in the introduction, I think, he gets into how he was having his own sleep dreams, his own difficult sleep dreams, that he was looking at and saying, gee, you know, these are a little bit concerning. He started to think that maybe he had, based on the dreams themselves, some form of throat cancer. He went into his doctor. He goes into his doctor and says, you know, doc, check me out. I think there's something going on here. They do all the tests. They do all that stuff, all the statistical examinations, la, 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 la. Nope, you look good. You're good to go. I wouldn't worry about it. He goes home, you know, feeling a sense of relief, of course. Oh, good, you know, like if the doctor says that this isn't happening, then chances are it's not. Starts having more dreams about it and goes back to the doctor. And basically, at the end of the introduction, he tells about how he goes to the doctor eventually, and one has to be careful when talking with one's medical physician about, you know, the precognitive abilities and powers and potencies of dreams. There are many instances of even friends that I know that have gone to the doctor and said, well, I have this dream and I'm concerned. You know, it's really easy to get laughed out of the consulting room in that way. But it turns out that the dreams were right in this case, and I've known other people that have had similar experiences where they felt like, wow, the dreams are telling me really something important here that I need to look into and deal with. So there's any number of actual anecdotal evidence that states that the dreams are way ahead of the curve when it comes to physical health and well-being. It's also true in my experience when it comes to psycho-spiritual health and wholeness, that the dreams are really far ahead of the curve. And what seems to be happening is that the dreams are coming up with this personal mythological narrative and saying, Travis, this is where things are at right now. Not just in terms of physical health and wholeness, but also in terms of psycho-spiritual health and wellness, emotional wellness. Then we get into the collective layers, the layers of how each dream is actually speaking to collective life, my experience as a dreamer of what it's like to be alive at this point in time, which starts to get into really interesting areas of possible creative solutions and ways of dealing with the biggest issues that we face today as human beings on the planet, including global warming, including environmental crises, including the changes in the weather, including consumerism. And in my opinion, working with the dreams is really like, along with several other authentic spiritual practices, any spiritual practice that devotes itself on an ongoing, regular basis to increasing levels of self-consciousness and self-awareness around the issues of being alive has the potency and has the opportunity to address on an important level these collective issues and challenges that we face today. There's any number of examples. I don't think I've spoken about this the times that I've been here before. Einstein came up with the theory of relativity based on a dream that he had, and it was actually a really fun dream. In the dream, he's sledding down a hill with some friends. People used to do that. I guess they still do where they have snow. You know, I did it when I was a kid. Hop on the sled and, you know, go find the biggest hill you can and get on top of the hill and hop on the sled and go whee all the way down. In Einstein's dream, that's what he does. He's with some friends and he's sledding. And in the dream, he goes faster and faster. He passes up his friends. He passes up the entire physical surroundings. And pretty soon, he's way out in space and the stars are going past. You know, he's like faster and faster. And he's actually on record as saying that that dream, that was the basis for the theory of relativity. And that really he spent his whole life trying to understand that one dream. And that's actually, I'll just offer this, that if we look hard enough, that could actually be true for all of us. There are really significant childhood dreams that come through, at least one or two at a specific point of time in our lives that, you know, come to mind. Even as I mention it, you know, there might be dreams that are popping into people's heads. I have my own example. And I keep coming back to it in interesting ways over the course of my life, almost like a personal mythological wellspring and source for the meaning of my personal path in life. Mendeleev came up with the periodic table of elements as a result of an afternoon sleep dream. Paul McCartney wrote the song Tomorrow. No, yesterday. Wait, which way am I going here?
Yeah, right.
I think it was yesterday. But it was one of the biggest, most successful pop songs of all times. He woke up and he had the music, you know, and he started writing it down. And he said one of the frustrating things was, and this is what all of the creative artists say about their dreams when they work with them and seek to draw inspiration from them, is that they never quite got it right. They never can quite get it as good as it is in the dream, which is just another underpinning example of the way that dreams are really dealing with evolution. You know, they're really that much ahead of the curve of where we are at a given moment in time. And so the last example that I'll give is Larry Gage, who came, he was one of the key creators of Google, the Google search engine. He came up with the idea for Google out of a sleep dream. And he had actually been working on that. He'd actually been thinking, like, how could I come up with, and he's a pretty young guy, I don't know what age he is, but he came up with it at a pretty early age. He was cooking this thing. He was what we call in DreamWorks incubating dreams around this, because he understood that his dreams could give him a key to understanding as to how to solve the problem. He was asking the question, how could I better connect people on the internet? And how could I better connect people with important and valuable and worthwhile information so that people don't have to swim through this whole sea of all this information? So, you know, these are some pretty big examples of the way that dreams can be valuable and can benefit not just individuals, but also the culture and the collective. I think at this point, I've been talking for a while. I think I'd like to open the floor to hear some questions. I also am going to tell the story tonight of Sudama and Krishna. Well, I think I'll do that after we have a chance for folks to ask some questions. It's also good for me. I've been talking for a while, not knowing what levels of experience all of you have in the room around paying attention to your own dreams. So I'd like to give an opportunity for folks to ask questions if there are any. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a day where I was really ill, detoxing.
Mm.
And the day after, I just stayed in bed.
Yeah.
And I kept having these little mini dreams.
Uh-huh.
And then my dog would wake me up or I'd fall and I'd go back.
Yeah.
And I had three in a row that or something was happening simultaneously. I was aware of what was happening in this world and in the sleep world. So, in other words, I remember, and my dog was sleeping next to me, one of my little dogs.
Yeah.
So, somebody was leaning towards me with a straw hat on, very benevolent, and they were going to take my hand, and they were getting physically close to me.
Yeah.
And my dog, in this life, started growling and lunging towards the dream person.
Wow.
So then I went back to sleep.
Yeah.
And there's this neighbor we have that's very difficult. He's tormenting and stalking about 20 different neighbors, and I'm one of them.
Mm.
And I had a dream that he was ripping out blackberries with his bare hands,
uh-huh.
and a bird came and slammed into the window next to where my head was.
Yeah, in waking life?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then somebody asked me a question in the sleeping dream, and I answered in the waking dream.
Hmm.
So I was just, and then that was, it was just three little vignettes.
Yeah.
But it never happened to me before where
uh-huh.
they were both talking to me at the same time.
Wow.
So.
Yeah. Is there a question in that?
No, I mean... That would be something that would be fun to share with the group.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll just say a few things that come to mind when I hear about that experience. It occurs to me that this is like, I would be grateful if I had that experience, I think. You know, I would also want to explore the meanings, like what are the messages that are happening. And it also sounds a little bit like what I could call like shamanic, you know. Like in the shamanic worldview, the spirits are always here, they're always present, they're always speaking. We can talk to them, we can also open up and receive messages from them. We can do journeys and receive information from them and have experiences with them. This particular dream experience strikes me along those lines, where there's a fusion. It seems like there's a fusion happening, that the separation between those two realities is thinner, and mm-hmm. and there's an intercourse happening, you know, there's an interchange happening. And I think that's beautiful, you know, as a dream experience. I would be very grateful for that, because as a dreamer and as a dream worker, one of the hopes that I have and one of the aims that I have, and this is also the aim of, you know, certain artists and mythologists and other teachers and folk, to really honor both worlds, to honor both worlds, or to honor as many worlds as there are. And there are dreamers who bring reports that say that there is a limitless number, just like there are meditators who also bring back information and say there's any number of worlds out there. Yeah, right.
Can you say a few words about your experience with synchronicity and mind coordinates?
Sure. Synchronicity is, I'm pretty sure everybody in this room has a handle on the meaning of that word, but I will say that I recently read Gary Lachman, who was he's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame drummer, the original drummer for Blondie, and he's turned into a scholar, and he's written several interesting biographies, and he just in 2011 did a biography of Carl Jung. And I like his distinction. He puts a distinction around synchronicity, saying that a synchronicity is an outwardly occurring event that resonates with some inner level of meaning. So it's not like just a coincidence the important piece, according to Lachman, and I tend to agree with this, is that it resonates with an inner level of meaning. Something that happens on an inner level also is mirrored in the outer world. The experience of synchronicity, the more I do this work, the more synchronicities show up, or the more I notice them. It's one of the valuable gifts of working with dreams, that the more time that I spend with this symbolic, metaphoric, dreamlike material, the more waking life starts to also look like that at certain times and in certain ways, and that's certainly present in the story that I heard you share, too. It's also possible to navigate waking life by recognizing synchronicities and to view them or understand them as dreams, as important messages that occur, that we can recognize certain layers of meaning around events that seem to put an exclamation mark behind our experience, so to speak, at given moments in time. And right now, I think the most significant thing about it is, on one important wavelength, it's like this wonderful confirmation, you know, it can be. Like, I experience it as a wonderful confirmation, like, oh, I'm doing my inner work, these things are happening, you know, things are occurring also in the outer world. It's also important, I think, every time something like that happens, to try and understand what's the message, what might be the meaning in the synchronicity. Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up, you said, you know, if you don't write down a dream or speak a dream within an hour, it usually slips away.
Right.
And along those lines, I had an experience, I'm going to tell very briefly. I had a dream. I had a house guest 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a child 30 years ago, but it was an early dream that made an impression.
Okay.
And I had a house guest. And in this dream, she was sitting on the floor and holding a mirror to me, and like facing me, but holding the mirror. And for one reason or another, when I woke up, I decided to think about this dream a little bit. And I realized, just in thinking about it in the first few minutes of waking, that, oh, it was very important that I didn't see myself in the mirror, and that she was actually reflecting this a little bit to the right of me.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if I had reflected on the dream later, I would have thought, she's holding a mirror to me, what does this mean?
Yeah, I do have a question.
Do you find that it's more fruitful insofar as to reflect on a dream, not only just to write it down and remember it, but to actually ponder the meaning of it you know, when it's fresh, is it more likely to be fertile in terms of what it might reveal?
Well, that's a really good question, and for me there's a bit of an answer in the story that I heard you share. The immediacy of the dreams, the original memory of the dream will tend to be more visceral. We will remember more things about them the more we record them and the more we spend time pondering them. It's not necessary to always be looking for the meaning. I think it's useful and helpful. It's also the experience. And sometimes just dwelling with the experience and contemplating the experience can give a gift. My experience is that one of the reasons I'm a big fan of recording dreams upon awakening is that we get those little details, and then we hopefully, I record almost every day some snippet of some dream. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, and I go through periods where, we call them dream droughts, where, it hasn't rained in a while around here. But part of the function of that is just to support ongoing memory of the dreams. But certainly, I've been in dream groups where people have brought dreams from 20 years ago, and we've worked it, and the dreamer gets something meaningful and valuable and rich and deep and insightful from it. So I know there are proponents who say, like, no, it has to be a recent dream, otherwise we're not going to know what's really happening with the dreamer. That, and it's really not that way in my experience. It's more like the dreams on one level appear to be islands in the ocean, and they appear to be isolated, and to have like restricted physical dimensions and all that. But if we were to put a scuba gear on and go diving down into the water and follow, the island all the way down to the floor of the ocean, oh gee, this thing's connected to all the rest of it. So it's a little bit like that. Yeah, it's a little bit like that. Yeah.
One question has to do with quality of sleep in dreams.
Yeah.
Because I notice that sometimes I'm not sleeping as well.
Mm.
Maybe as deeply or, for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And my dreams, not that I always remember them, but they seem to be more palpable versus when I'm in deep slumber. And also, for me, when I have been ill, especially fever, I definitely have.
Yeah.
More dreams, or at least I recollect them more.
Right.
So I was curious about that and studies or your experience with that.
Sure.
And then the other question is with lucid dreaming. Just curiosities with where is that with the unconscious versus not, you're being willful.
Those are great topics. So recalling dreams is really interesting. And that topic is really interesting because there are any number of reasons that we either do or don't remember our dreams. The primary, if a person wants to remember their dreams, that's the biggest aid and assistance to the memory of dream experiences. If I just earnestly decide, hey, I get this thing, I get the fact that dreams are returning me to missing pieces of myself, and I want that. I want to experience health and wholeness. So, doggone it, I'm going to pay attention to my dreams and I'm going to remember them. That, in and of itself, is the biggest impact and the biggest influence on remembering dreams. Now, the levels, different levels of sleep, there have been studies. These days it's really cool because, a lot of what I'm saying is backed up by actual laboratory research. People since like the 1970s have been doing laboratory research, and there's tons of neuroscientists and folks that are really fascinated in dreams as well. And they're coming at it from a, what we can we prove empirically here kind of level. The depth of sleep, we all sleep, we all dream. I don't know if we all sleep. We all dream. An average, a conservative estimate is
6 years out of a lifetime. You know, that would be like the average. We spend 6 years of our lives dreaming. I want to do something with that 6 years, you know. You know, the impact of the moon. We have an astrologer, a local astrologer, Polly Costa, who comes to the groups, and she will give like an astrological sort of angle on the dreams, which is really wonderful to get that. That can impact and influence in my studies, my own dreams, all the other things that are going on in my life at that time, but also particularly for women, but also for men, the moon. The cycle and the phases of the moon has an impact on how we do or don't recall our dreams. Just like the moon affects the tides and the waves of the ocean. The thing about lucidity, that's a really interesting area of dream work and dream research and dream experience. What I'd like to say about it is that because of the way that the funding has gone, Stephen LaBerge is like Mr. Lucidity. He's the guy. And, you know, the fact of lucid dreaming, the definition of it has suffered a little bit in relationship to the way that the lucid dream researchers have gotten funding. Because in order to write their grants, they've had to validate, you know, we're really doing something here. It's worth giving us money, you know, because we're really doing something important here. So the definition has gotten what I would call mistakenly literalized, so that there are any number of folks walking around on the planet today who say, well, it's not a lucid dream if I don't say to myself in the dream, wow, I'm having a dream, right? That there are actually all these other layers and levels of indicators of lucidity. And I'll just refer you to, I really like Jeremy Taylor's The Wisdom of Your Dreams as a wonderful dream book. And he's got a whole section in there about the other types of lucid dreams that occur. That, you know, lucid is kind of a buzzword now, but basically it means awareness. And there are all sorts of different ways that we become aware in dreams. Looking in a mirror in a dream is a symbolic metaphor of awareness and inhabits a certain level of lucidity in its quality. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Michael, did you have something?
What is a dream?
What is a dream? I would say that a dream is a remembered experience that occurs to a person either while he or she is asleep or awake that involves and engages the imaginal functions of being and also affects and influences the physical layers of experience and being.
That's everything.
Everything's a dream.
That would be my definition.
That was cool.
Thanks. Thank you. So, I don't know if I can do it again. But you know what? I want to move on because I want to tell this story tonight. But actually, it's going to be on the recording, so it'll be on the website. Thank you for the question, Michael. I want to give people an experience.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
I wish you had made a little space before answering it, because I think the question is very important.
Okay.
And it deserves, because I agree. I think that the dream is what happens when everything that inhibits our creativity is disabled, and like when we fall asleep, and
yes,
those things that disable our natural creativity of ourselves become disabled, and then so suddenly we're right there swimming in the absolute creativity of ourselves, and so they get the stage, whereas in our waking hours, something else takes over the stage.
Yeah.
And so I think that it is possible to be in that state, that condition, all of the time.
Gotcha.
And I think that pause, and especially what comes with the asking of a big question,
sure,
can help to bring us into into that space.
Sure. Thank you for what you said about the creativity of dreams. I appreciate that very much. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, I didn't mean to rush ahead, but I do want to tell the story of Sudama and Krishna, because I've been saying a lot of theoretical things about dreams. And as Joseph Campbell once said, I think he was on the mark, he said that myths, folk tales, are public dreams. And that dreams are like private myths. And these two things feed into each other. And so, in the absence of being able to work a dream here tonight, I've told stories when I came in the past, but it occurred to me tonight that I really wanted to introduce this as an experience of having a dream that we can share together. And so I'm going to tell this story, and I'd like you to enter an imaginal space as I tell this story. And this will afford us an opportunity to experience a little bit of hopefully what I've been talking about. We have a group assembled here, we have a community assembled here, and in a sense even Michael's comment is a great introduction to this, because we're almost going to be hopefully dreaming while we're awake in listening to this story. So, without further ado, the story of Sudama and Krishna, which is also known as the story of the million steps. sitar. Let us once again make sweet music together, my friend. As Krishna says this, the thousands and thousands of minstrels, musicians, troubadours, muses, and storytellers disappear. It is only Sitama and Krishna together for days. It goes on like suffering. Pay special attention to any part of the story that stands out to you now. Could be a feeling around the story. or a particular scene in the story. Just take a few moments and find that for yourself. Feel like you've found a part of the story that's speaking to you. Come on back into the room. Feel free to stay there if that suits you. But I'd like to hear from a few folks about what part of the story stands out. And this then would be a way of recognizing and talking about the projections that we make onto the story as a public dream. And it also affords us an opportunity to just, you know, talk a little bit. Stories are like dreams, and dreams are like medicine, and medicine is like music. And all of these things are sort of wrapped up. That's why I wanted to tell this story tonight, because these things all conjoin together in the story. So what appears to folks? Yeah.
What stuck with me is the last part, singing praises of the divine, and just the amount of synchronicity around India, around watched a documentary last night about folks from the West who live now their whole life in India, kind of stayed stuck in India.
Mm.
One of them lives in an abandoned hut.
Oh.
And he does his things, praises of the divine. Just the synchronicity of it.
And is there like any rich level of meaning in the synchronicity that stands out that seems like a personal message for you?
Yeah, I think the personal message is about devotion for me and what in my exploration about what that means for me personally. Seeing, especially in India, this feels like the culture is very much more devotional than what I've seen here in the West. Just kind of tuning into different cultures and what devotion means to them. And it feels like it's coming home, and I'm getting a better understanding, more like finding myself for myself. What does.
Thank you. Yes.
What I got out of it was the realization that Mimi had at the end.
Yeah.
That no matter what your circumstances are, life is the same.
Mm.
There will be suffering, there will be joy, there will be sadness. Everything is the same, no matter what your circumstances. Life does not change.
So kind of what I hear in that is kind of a like maybe an acceptance of home, like what we talk about in this dream work, wholeness, the path towards wholeness. Like an acceptance that sometimes things are pleasurable and sometimes they're painful and sometimes there's suffering and sometimes there's joy. Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
The most powerful part for me was that Sudama.
Yeah, Sudama, yeah.
His dream and the serpent Kalyana.
Kalyana, and
the serpent totally had Krishna wrapped all the way up. And the brother said, "Hey, Krishna, you're God, you know." And then opens one eye, and then the next eye, and the next thing, he's dancing on the serpent's head.
Yeah.
And it's funny how things like that often happen in dreams. They're going kind of a bad way, and then nothing. There's not really much of a transition, but suddenly you're dancing on the serpent's head, or things are entirely different. And the logical part of me wanted to go, no, wait a minute. Then what happened? He opened an eye. You know, how did he get the snake to uncoil? And you know, was that kind of thing? So, insofar as it has meaning for me, I think maybe it just I don't have to always figure everything out. It's kind of like Saddam's wife said at the end, you take one step toward the divine, and the divine takes one step toward you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't have seen that myself, I don't think. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
I think what attracted me the most or brought up the most was the relationship with the divine.
Yeah.
The relationship with Krishna and Sudama.
Uh-huh.
Because when you said the words, if you take one step towards the divine, the divine takes a million steps towards you.
Yeah.
So there's that interruption, this heart, physical.
Wow.
Wow.
Bliss moment.
Say it again, please.
Are you having a hard time hearing back there?
Oh, no, the car just...
Oh, yeah. Maybe a little louder, too.
Oh, yeah.
The last part.
Still there.
Yeah, I hear you.
Oh, I was just saying that when you said the words, when you take one step toward the divine takes a million steps toward you, it was like a physical sensation in the center of my body, sort of bliss or something, connection, electricity.
That's wonderful. That points up in terms of like observing the different experiences. That's a really valuable and valid experience. And that's the kind of thing that happens in the dream work, is that some people will have a feeling, you know, it'll be felt in the body. Mm-hmm. Other people will have ideas, or, you know, other people will have intuitions. So that's wonderful. And all of it is valid, and all of it is important. Yeah. Thank you. Yes?
I like the reconnection of the childhood friendship. Mm.
Ah.
The innocence and the joy.
Yeah. So would you be willing to say just a little bit about what that might mean for you, and like why that might be, why you might be noticing that part of the story?
I would probably cry.
Okay. Well, it's your choice. You don't have to say anything if you don't want to. But yeah, thank you. Yeah. Any other impressions? Yeah.
I was very taken by the fact that his wife was so loving and supportive in spite of all her poverty.
Uh huh.
And when he came back and he wanted to stay in the hermitage,
yeah,
he went back to her and said, "Will you go with me?"
Yeah.
And eventually she did.
Yeah.
And as if that's different parts of her own self that became united and together, and could then together sing the praises of the divine.
That
the closeness, either between man and woman in a love relationship, or between different parts of ourselves in a love relationship.
Yeah.
I found that very touching.
Thank you. That's one of the details that stood out to me as I was familiarizing myself with the story as well. And I think, you know, I've been to India just in terms of waking life stuff. And anybody who's been there, and there might be several people in the room who have been there, there are several levels of intensity there. And there's been all this stuff in the media lately about the mistreatment of women and whatnot in India. And I think we had not too long ago, a conversation down at Esalen while I was there for a shamanic training, and that came out. And I found myself just longing for like some representation or some healing around the divine feminine, you know. So that's a pertinent for me as well, part of the story. And for me in the story, at least the way that I read it, and maybe in the way that I'm telling it, there's great importance on the feminine, and that's there. And it's not just the feminine, but it's like, you know, Krishna is like, you know, he's the masculine lord of the universe, but in this other important way, Padmini is playing this sort of role of a more hidden but still divine, for me, in my experience of the story, element, where she's like, you know, reminding Sudama, the masculine part of herself, in from one view, that hey, you know, all of this worthlessness is kind of nonsense. You know, there's a level of divinity inside each and every one of us. And I'll just share this brief anecdote. I had a really powerful experience. I was practicing this story at home on Sunday, and I like to leave room, like Martin Shaw says, burn the script and allow the story to get wet. I tried not to, you know, learn the story by rote, and I tried to leave some space for spontaneous expression, authentic expression. But I found that the and you may find this as well after coming to the talk tonight, I would pay attention to dreams tonight and in the morning. But I had a really powerful dream after practicing this story, and it just really drove home to me. I think this was kind of, in a sense, the most earnest approach that I took towards the storytelling. It really drove home to me the power of the story that is talking about music, and it is talking about dreams, and it is talking about these deeply potent energies. So it brought up for me layers of my own tendency to think of myself as worthless, and it invited me to go and visit Krishna and to remember my sense of true divinity. Well, I think we're almost at that moment. There's just a couple things that I want to say, and I actually want to start passing this. I have an email list. If you'd like to sign it, if you'd like to receive emails from me about other stuff that I do, the groups, workshops, please feel free to sign it. I'm also offering anybody who is here tonight, part of the talk, one free dream work session, individual session. So if you're interested in that, just indicate on the right-hand column that you're interested in doing that. And just pass this around and sign it. And as I'm wrapping up here, and some of you may already be on the list, thank you so much for being here tonight. I always enjoy and appreciate. I sometimes have come to talks here as well myself, and I really deeply value the fact that you all offer this on Thursday nights. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really, really helpful and wonderful community offering, so thank you for that. If you're interested in contacting me or getting information about my work, I have cards, postcards. You can get a hold of me in either of these ways. And I do ongoing groups in the area, so if you have any level of interest after tonight's experience, I heartily, heartily invite you to come. It's a wonderful community experience, especially for introverts. Not exclusively for introverts, but especially for introverts. And I'm finding that it's really paradoxical, because I have a great time spending time with other people working dreams as an introvert. And it's like this sort of odd territory for me where I'm like, finding that I feel a little bit more connected sometimes when I'm with other people working dreams now than I do when I'm by myself. So I really invite you to come and check it out. We'd love to have you come. It's a rich and a diverse group of folks. Thank you so much for your time and energy and attention. Yes, Marty?
Don't you have a full-day workshop coming up too?
Yes, I have a Friday evening and an all-day Saturday workshop coming up in April, and that will be April 19th and April 20th. And that's a really good opportunity to really experience with depth some of the things that we've hopefully experienced here tonight. We do on Friday night a full-on sound incubation, sound healing, where we grow dreams, where I play the didgeridoo and I play other instruments, and folks lie down on the ground and people set intentions about receiving healing dreams. And actually, one of the participants of one of these incubations incubated a dream around whether or not to have a major surgery. So speaking of practical applications of this work, and she shared the dream the next morning in the group and was able to make a really informed decision about having a major surgery, which turned out well in the end. So yes, I would love it if anybody wanted to come and join us for the workshop. And I post stuff around town from time to time. I also want to let people know I have some CDs here that are sound healing CDs, meditation CDs, Yoro Yoro, which I'm really proud of, one of my musical offerings that folks use in yoga classes. Folks have been using it in birthing classes and actual birthing experiences. And Jeremy Taylor himself said about the album, the idea behind the album is to basically inspire the experience that everything is alive through music. So it's kind of like dreaming through sound. And Jeremy Taylor, one of my mentors himself, said, "This is the music of that." So if that's of any help to you.
Is it didgeridoo?
Yes, it's primarily didgeridoo, but it's multi-instrumental. And Manos, who is an amazing Krishna-like flute player, who plays devotional flute music, is on the album. Tina Malia, who some people know, sings beautiful, lovely, amazing voice, sings some Sanskrit chants on the album. It's very supportive of meditative states. Yeah.
Just say something. I have that album Euro, and there's two things. One is that when I'm working, because I spend a lot of time working, writing, editing stuff, and sometimes I'm just too restless and I can't do it. And I put that on, and I just, not only am I able to focus, but I'm able to focus happily.
That's great.
And then also it's just beautiful. It's just, I just love listening to it when I'm not necessarily working. It's just working.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very, very meaningful to me. Thank you so much. Yeah. So if folks want to hang out and ask me questions afterwards, I'll be available for that. There are any number of wonderful dream books over here. I can heartily recommend Dreams by Sanford, which is good for folks who are coming from a Christian background or Christian perspective. The Kin of Atta Are Waiting for You, which is a wonderful fictional storytelling account of powerful work with dreams. And beautiful allegory of some of the things that are possible in working with dreams. Conscious Dreaming by Robert Moss is also a great, wonderful, helpful book, particularly for folks who want to learn more about just all the various states and experiences of dreams that occur. And I know that you guys want to make an ending announcement, so please.
Which is first to thank you for coming tonight.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. There is a donation basket over on the counter there. We encourage you to contribute to it. We split what you donate with our speakers to further their work and retain the other half to help maintain this space so that we can continue to do these things in the future. Mm. And thank you again for coming to Many Rivers tonight. We look forward to seeing you again and
thank
all
you.
Of you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.